health and fitness with the newly refurbished Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club. Refresh your fitness journey with dedicated personal trainers on hand to help you achieve your goals. Find out more at MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. Get up off that couch. Stop watching TV. All the screen time is a disaster. A common refrain from older generations to new. Are we sitting around more? What are the consequences if we are? A Midlands University is leading a pan-European study into physical activity among young people. We meet the lead researcher. Nutritionists are great at telling you what to eat. What about what they eat? Our resident nutrition expert opens her fridge to us today. And we catch up with the head of coaching and games for Laois GAA on how they're getting on bringing Gaelic games to the next generation. We are moving our eyes and our attention over to the Technological University of the Shannon in Athlone. They are leading a pan-continental, or I should say, a pan-European groundbreaking study into people and physical inactivity, young people in particular. Young people, of course, are set to inherit the world that we leave for them. What exactly we do leave for them is another question for another interview on this programme, maybe. But one of the issues that they may well be developing themselves is physical inactivity, that sedentary lifestyle that you may have heard so much about. The study is called In Deep, and joining us on Health and Fitness this evening to talk us through it is the study lead, Dr. Kieran Dowd, who is a lecturer in the Department of Sport and Health Sciences and a researcher in the SHE Research Group as well in Tús Athlone, who they're doing great work as well, I must say. Kieran, really delighted you would take the time to talk to us on the programme this evening.
Great. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
So I've given a brief, relatively cack-handed, unscientific description of the study that's being done. You might give us a more detailed idea of what is going on with the In Deep study and maybe more importantly, why it's happening.
Okay, so In Deep, I suppose, broadly, is a project that's aimed at trying to better understand why young people are or are not physically active. So as you've said there, that young people in Ireland at the minute, we generally think of the really active ones that are participating in sport, and we're driving them around the country, participating in all these activities 5-6 days a week. And that gets a lot of the discussion, and we talk about burnout and all of these other things. But what doesn't get talked about an awful lot, I suppose, is that an awful lot of our young people don't achieve the recommended amount of physical activity. So we should be getting 60 minutes of moderate intensity or vigorous intensity physical activity on average each day as a 5 to 17 year old. And we know that an awful lot, the most recent study kind of looked at 13% of our youth achieving the recommended amount of physical activity in Ireland. So what we know is that there's lots of things that impact participation in physical activity. So we generally think to ourselves of a parent that's involved with sport or involved in activity, that's a big influence. And it is. It plays an important role. But there are lots of other things. So we don't really think all the time about the environment. We never normally think about how our genes and our genetic buildup is an enormous influence, not just in terms of the behaviors that a parent or a sibling does, but that our actual genetic makeup is a very, very big important factor. So there's other things like environment and policy in terms of the role that our government and our local councils and communities, what role they play in terms of promoting physical activity. So In Deep is essentially trying to gather all of that information together. Mm. So we're bringing experts from the area of genetics and from the area of policy and from the areas of understanding interpersonal relationships and that impact on physical activity. So there's been some work done on it previously, but really getting a better understanding of what influence these different things have on our physical activity. It hasn't really been done, or it hasn't been done on a scale that we can make it like quite impactful.
Kieran, so that sounds like a massive amount of work. And as you've alluded to there, maybe certain pillars of issues behind physical activity have been well analysed. But it kind of stupefies me to think how you go about enveloping all of this collectively. It's great ambition. It must take a huge amount of planning and ultimately a lot of concentrated minds to deliver on such a brief.
It does. And we're lucky we have a big consortium. So there's 10 researchers that are from 8 different institutions from 6-7 different countries across Europe that are going to be in charge of leading specific elements of it in their own institutions. So the big part about the type of funding that we've got, it's actually not just about the research, but it's also about trying to build people with expertise in this area. So in hopefully a couple of months' time, we'll have 10 PhD students starting. There'll be one in Athlone. There's a number in the University of Limerick, and we have more in Norway, in the Netherlands, in Portugal, and they're going to be the people. So I suppose our skills as researchers, we're going to come together. We have a plan, and we're going to try to then train these 10 new researchers to kind of build on this topic, to build the infrastructure, and to create the whole idea. It's a Marie Curie funding. A doctoral network. And the whole idea is to build the next generation of researchers to really advance this field going forward. So it's a big team. So there's a lot of people working on it. I'm just the lucky enough person to have brought a group of people together. It was through our involvement in previous work. But there's a big team of people there. Each one of those PhDs would have a number of other supervisors that will guide them as well in locally and internationally. But yeah, it does. It takes a lot of work trying to piece everything together, but we're hopeful that we'll do a good job of it.
It's very interesting because you hear about institutional knowledge, like it could occur when a particular university or a third level education facility spends a lot of time researching in a direction and maybe it produces PhD students all along that way. But this is kind of expanding on from that and kind of trying to create legacy knowledge around this overall issue. We could be reaping dividends from it for a long time then, but by the same token, it might not be clear what those dividends are until you get through almost a generation of students and educators.
I suppose, look, the big outcome of what we hope from this or the part of our plan is that for the first two phases of it is for us to learn as much as we can about what actually constitutes, what actually makes people more active or less active. And we're hoping to get a good picture of that. Mm. The big outcome that we'll get out of this, we're hoping, will be a process whereby we can take what we learn. So from doing an investigation into an individual or a group of children in a secondary school, in just a first year of a local college in Athlone, for example, that we can get a picture of what is influencing them. From that, we're hoping we have a number of PhDs that will focus on, well, how do we translate this? How can we actually say, okay, we know that these are the factors that are influencing that group of students or those individuals, and that we can use that information to build an intervention specifically focused on those groups based on the factors that are impacting them, and that will implement the intervention based on these findings. So that we will hope that within a couple of years, by the end of the project in about 3.5 years, that we'll have a toolkit that will be the first step in that. So the outputs that we'll get are hopefully the translation to the general population will be available relatively quick. Mm. The thing about it is that with a lot of these projects, what we'll do is we're going to demonstrate how feasible this is. And we're hopefully looking then to scale it, to try to make this bigger so that we can gather more information and that we can make our intervention toolkit or how we're going to change the behaviors of these people, we can make it stronger. So this is probably the first leg. And at the end of this, like you said, is that we'll have a group of people that will have the expertise to develop this, but that passing on to the next generation will be up to that next generation of researchers. It'll be up to them to really say, well, how do we now scale this and potentially look at a pan-European system that we can implement at a national level all across Europe to get a better picture of what's going on, because there'll be such cultural differences. national differences, like it's going to take time to get to that level. So this is kind of the first step, what we hope.
After the break, Ciarán's going to talk us through the scale of the challenge that faces him and his research colleagues.
Health and fitness with the newly refurbished Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club. Take the plunge in a new routine with our swimming pool, plunge pool, jacuzzi, sauna and steam room. For more, visit MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. Welcome back. When we left our discussion with Dr. Ciarán Dowd, the in-deep study lead, he was talking to us about the long-term potential for their study into physical inactivity among young people. I wanted to ask him, is the problem of sedentary behaviour so big that it'll take generations of researchers to find solutions?
Simple answer is yes. Look at what we know is that in terms of the behaviours of our young people, so the idea of sedentary behaviour is a relatively new concept in terms of the area of research. We've known for a long time that low levels of physical activity and high levels of inactivity are bad. That if we don't reach the exercise recommendations, it has impact on a whole range of health outcomes. Obesity is the one we'll always go to, but we know that at an early stage in young people, we see the evidence there for the buildup of plaque in our arteries and all the additional things, that this is happening at an earlier and earlier age because of all of the technological developments that we have, and we don't get as much active transport as we used to. All of these things, they all have an impact. For sedentary behavior, it's slightly different, is that this is new, is that, yeah, we're sitting more, but the idea is that there's a different mechanism at play there, that the sedentariness is a big issue for us to deal with, and it's only getting worse. We're sitting for more and more per day. We're looking at our screens more and more. The opportunities for physical activity are less and less. And we think, or we have been trying to change these behaviors for a long time, but we've been having limited success. We're just not we're not having the impact. If we look to the CSPPA report that was published relatively recently, is that how have we changed since 2010? And we have a lot of things implemented in Ireland, but our activity levels of our young people aren't increasing. If anything, you could say at the best case scenario, they're probably maintaining, and they're maintaining at 15-18% if we're giving a little bit of scope for change. Or a little bit of scope for to play with kind of what the numbers might actually mean. So the problem is at the very least maintaining, and there is such a need for continued work in terms of how we get young people more active. This is one of the elements to it. There's an awful lot of more work going on, and simply it's not a call of action for everybody. I know people don't want to be hearing about this, but we need to invest. We really do need to invest in people. It's not just in research, but like that we know the impacts of this, but we just don't have the people on the ground at the minute that can have a meaningful impact at the level we need to. So yes, the answer, simple answer to your question is that we need to continue to invest, because the problems that we're seeing, they're still there, and they're not going away anytime soon.
It's encouraging to know that this in-deep study exists and has got that level of ambition to acknowledge how big the issue is and to take it head on. I want to bring you back to something you mentioned about the study itself, is that there are multiple different institutions that will be working on this, and you mentioned that each one might take a particular focus and then the knowledge will be pooled together collectively. Do you know at this point what the focus of study would be in Athlone, for instance, or do any of the institutions know exactly what they're doing at this point?
Yeah, we do. So we designed the project based on the expertise in each institution. So for in Athlone, as the coordinator, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be managing kind of the. So we're going to be creating ways in which we gather information. So, for example, some of our partners in Norway and the University of Limerick will be in charge of how we measure the physical activity. Nice. So we'll use a small device. It's a Thai-worn device that we plan to use. And we need to develop how we how we're going to process the information. So those two sites will lead on that. In Athlone, what we'll do is we'll build. So that in, just say, in the Netherlands and in other institutions, they'll do all the different things for genetics, for environmental determinants, and how we measure these. They'll do it separately, and we bring all of that together. And what we'll do in Athlone then is that we'll bring together all of the researchers that are involved to do a training school, and we'll upskill everybody on how, in each of these different sites, we can gather the information. So then our other responsibility in Athlone would be to determine how well we actually do what we want to do. So we'll do process evaluation. So we'll just look across the other sites. If we're gathering information, we want to know that it's consistently being measured in each of the different locations. So our student here would be responsible for ensuring that, and then to examine whether that is actually achieved, because the only way that we can kind of relatively certain that we're getting consistent information across a pan-European study like this is to ensure that the process is clear and is easy to implement. So in Athlone, along with kind of coordinating it and trying to manage all the other moving parts, we'll ensure that the actual implementation of the project is consistent across all of Europe.
A kind of quality control responsibility.
Yeah, essentially, because when we're reporting on all of this information, if we want to scale this in 5 years' time, that we do manage to receive some funding from the European Union or from wherever it may be to upscale this project, to start gathering more information, we need to have proof to say that, well, we can do this. We can share this. We can share the procedures that we've used, and that they can consistently be implemented across Europe. It's an important part of any scaling of a project like that, is to ensure that the messaging and the information is clear. So that's what we will do in Athlone. We'll try to help all the other locations as well in terms of what they're doing, and we'll provide input wherever it's required. But each different project, so like I said, in Limerick, there's two different projects that will be underway. One of them will be on kind of our intrapersonal determinants, what within us makes us active and not active. So they will develop all of the procedures around how we measure that. And in the other, like we have a policy group in Portugal, for example, they'll develop the policy elements that we need to examine and the impacts that that has. So each of these different sites has a different responsibility, and we'll just try to tie all of this together and ensure that when we do the data collection, it's done in a good way.
Yeah, so that can, as you say, potentially be the roadmap or the blueprint for much bigger work as time goes on. Kieran, as an academic, finally, I'd just like to ask you, from a personal perspective, I've no idea what this would be like to be a part of, or to even be a study lead in this, but it sounds very exciting from your perspective. How do you find it personally to be involved in this project?
Look, it's enormously exciting. We participate in research because it's something that, you know, a spark came at some point in your head that said, I like that. And my actual final year project as my undergraduate program was supervised by the individual in charge of the determinants piece in Limerick. And at that time, there was just something in the research process and in what we were studying that I just loved. And it's probably been there since. That was the reason why I went on and undertook my PhD, and to get to a scale, to the stage now where you're able to lead a project is fantastic. Like it's kind of, you get to put your own piece or you put your own ideas into a proposal, and other people, the recognition from other people say that they think it's good and it's worthwhile. It's great. There's a lot of additional work, and there's a lot of, I'm not going to say stress, but there's a lot of, it takes time, and with other responsibilities in terms of your lecturing position and other supervisions, it's busy, but look at, it's something that you do because you're interested in, and it's extremely exciting. It's great for me, the department. We have a fantastic department, a fantastic research group. It's growing all the time, and it's a great place to be for myself. Yeah, look, it's exciting. That's the best way.
Next, an awfully nutritionist opens her fridge for you to have a nose in. Now, in health and fitness, we do like to enlist the help of the professionals when it comes to certain elements of advice and discussion, as I'm certainly not qualified to do so. And regular listeners will certainly have received plenty of wise counsel on how we should approach nutrition. I'm very glad to say and welcome back Breda Malini from Forban, our resident nutritionist here on health and fitness. And instead of Breda maybe telling us what we should and shouldn't be doing, I'm going to ask her to open up her fridge to the listeners this evening and talk us through how she goes about it. So you're on the spot, Breda. How do you feel about today, this evening's chat?
I think this will be a nice chat, because I think people kind of think that I have everything perfect and I do everything just right. And I, you know, we're all human and we all like different things in the fridge, and you have, you're catering for family, so everyone has different tastes. So my shopping is geared around all of that.
Okay, that's a good point as well, is that so much of what you want to do for yourself is always compromised by what you're doing for everybody else and what the agreed consensus of what we enjoy together is as well. This is all important family stuff. So when you Absolutely. Are considering getting your fridge full for a week or a couple of weeks, how do you go about it? What's your kind of passion of shopping when it comes to the groceries?
Well, I try as much as possible to have an idea of kind of what food, what particularly the dinners that will be going on during the week. That would be my starting point. Everyone has, I think, recipes to fall back on, so you kind of tend to have similar recipes throughout the week. So a lot of my grocery shopping will be based about most of my recipes. Obviously, I'm cooking all the time, so I love trying out different recipes. And I'd have, I suppose, depending on what you'd be doing during the week, I could do a vegetarian night and things like that. So kind of I like to vary it up. I love things like lots of spices, lots of herbs, all of that sort of thing. So that will definitely be included when I do shopping. Obviously, herbs and that wouldn't have to be bought every week. You know, you buy your sachets or you can buy the fresh herbs or
but
whatever.
But you do have a bit of a plan going out.
Yes. Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah. You'd have to have, because, you know, you go into a supermarket and, you know, it's what you're hit with and can become very expensive.
Yeah.
If you don't go in with a general list of what you're aiming for. On my list would always be vegetables, always vegetables, preferably in season, but not always the case. Fresh fruit as well. They would be the two main goals of on every week's budget or every week's list. And things like your kidney beans, your chickpeas, your tinned tomatoes, they would all be part, depending on what's left in the press after a couple of weeks. So they would all be part, because I do make a lot of my sauces from scratch, because there's less in them and you're more in control of actually what you're actually eating by cooking these things from scratch. You can make I batch cook as well. So I freeze a lot. So kind of I'm always have a fallback if possible.
Okay.
It doesn't always work out, but it does.
No, well, exactly. On the batch cooking perspective, I think to a lot of people it might sound like a lot of work, but is it one of those things that once you get into the rhythm of it, you realise that you're saving yourself work ultimately when it comes to days two or three or however way you kind of work that out?
Yeah, I would batch cook particularly soups at the end of the week. You know, you can throw everything into a soup. You can blend it up. All you're just doing is a big pot and everything goes in. So it's not actually very complicated, and depends on your taste. Then, you know, you add your seasonings and all of that and then let it cool and freeze it in portion sizes. So I use that an awful lot for work. So I have something I can take out of the freezer in the morning. I don't have to think about it. It's in the lunch bag, ready for lunchtime. And that and some brown bread or whatever.
And the difference between spending £4 to £8 in a shop, a garage or a deli compared to how much you're spending on your lunch when you do that, there's huge financial incentive. And obviously now, look, you're coming across very healthy. You've got fresh vegetables, you've got fresh fruit, you've got batch cooking, all the vegetables for the soup and everything like that. What do you pick up in the kind of aisles that have the more processed goods, stuff that we typically counsel against, but stuff we probably all indulge in to some degree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're, you know, there's a huge issue, I think. People are so afraid to pick up something out of a different aisle. It depends on how processed. There's, you have processed foods and you have ultra processed foods. I do genuinely try to avoid the ultra processed foods, which have so many different ingredients and they have a shelf life of could be 2 years or whatever. I try to avoid them as much as possible. But I do pick up a packet of biscuits. I do pick up cake. I love my dark chocolate. So I definitely would pick up that. Things like that. And there's weeks that you'd say, okay, I'd love something different. You'd pick up maybe a pizza, that sort of thing. So, but there wouldn't be an everyday indulgence, you know, everyday food.
Mm.
It's as a treat. And that's the difference.
Yeah. And it becomes more the treat long as you can kind of keep it in that 5%, 10% of the time zone.
Exactly.
There's an interesting point about how, you know, you've got a bit of a plan when you go out to get the groceries, you know what kind of dinners you want to cook. That helps to lessen the amount of food wastage. And I think it's worth pausing on that as well. Do you struggle with that yourself personally? Are you very particular about it? How do you manage avoiding food wastage? Because obviously in this hemisphere of the world, we're absolutely ridiculous for throwing away food.
If you think that, you know, things like I love my spinach. Okay, so I buy fresh spinach, but I stick it in the freezer straight away because I have had more occasions where I've had this black sludge in the bottom of my fridge where spinach has gone.
You can't get through it quick enough, can you?
No. So if you just literally put it in the bag, leave it in the bag, stick it in the freezer and just take it out in handfuls, then within seconds it's defrosted in whatever you're using it to cook in, like eggs or stews or soups or whatever. So that is my way of preserving. That frozen vegetables are perfectly fine to use, absolutely. And things like, even if you're big into making smoothies, get your frozen berries. There is absolutely nothing wrong with frozen berries, and at least then you're not looking at this going blue mold in your fridge, and that cuts out an awful lot of the waste.
It's tricky because when you're trying to pinch the pennies, as it were, buying larger batches of healthy food can seem like a really sensible thing to do. But as you say, that stuff is perishable. And I've been in the position where I know I'm not getting through what I've got in the fridge. And it's an awful feeling. It's really irritating.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's a waste of money. It's actually genuinely a waste of money. And groceries have got so expensive in the last while. That, you know, to avoiding that, but definitely frozen vegetables, frozen berries. If you're buying fresh spinach, stick it in the freezer and just use it accordingly as you need it. And it lasts. And same with herbs, spices. I freeze all my chilies, I freeze my ginger, I freeze turmeric, all of that. I put that in a box in the freezer and I grate it then into whatever I will be cooking.
Breeda, you must have the world's most enormous freezer.
I don't. No. I have a family's hand. No.
All right. So everyone listening can do this as well. We can all get a lot of this stuff frozen and obviously, as you described there, preserved. You alluded to the fact that, you might have some vegetarian days. There's some sort of like days where you have a bit of an indulgence, like a pizza. And by the sounds of it, when you're putting together your dinners, you have got some vegetables in there. You've got some decent carbohydrates in there. What kind of meals are you usually putting together for a dinner?
I do. On a Tuesday night, we do a family dinner. So that's normally a lasagna.
Nice.
So that's one day. And chances are, most times I have enough left over for the Wednesday.
Yeah.
So I kind of just either lunch or dinner the Wednesday evening with maybe an additional few vegetables roasted or something like that. So I roast an awful lot of my vegetables as well because I love them roasted.
They're that bit sweeter, aren't they?
Pardon?
They're that bit sweeter, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just that nice. And you're not losing an awful lot if you're boiling them. You're not, you know, when you boil them, you lose so much of the nutrients through the water. And a lot of people end up dumping that. So either if you're not into the roasting, steam them as much as possible, then you're not losing the nutrients out, sounds, leaking into the water.
Preferable to drinking broccoli juice, which is what the privilege I got when I was growing up. It's not the worst, actually.
I always meant gravy with it.
Ah, yeah, again. These are better ideas. So you've got recurring meals that everyone enjoys like that. What else in terms of dinners?
I like my fish. I have to say I like fish, and I like to definitely have that at least twice a week. Either be it white fish, which is your cod or your coolie or haddock or something like that, or salmon.
Okay. And talk to us about the health benefits from having fish in your diet as a general staple, because it is quite important.
Yeah, it's particularly the oily fish side of things, because you're talking about increasing your omega-3s, which is anti-inflammatory. There's anti-aging as well. So there's a lot of benefits. It's good for your heart health, and it's also good for your brain health. So those few things alone is what make it worthwhile eating some fish a couple of times a week. And we don't, generally speaking, eat enough of it. Mm. You know, obviously, it can be expensive, which is kind of what puts people off. And we always associated, I think a certain generation was associated with the Friday.
Yeah, of course.
We always got it on a Friday. But there's so much you can do with it. You can switch it up. You can have frozen prawns. You can add them in and do a prawn tagliatelle with broccoli and things like that, which is fabulous, I have to say. Your salmon, you can just do it regularly in kind of little parcels with some lemon, some rosemary, and just bake it in the oven. And you can put it on, if you wanted to put on some dried tomatoes on that. You know, you're making a really, really delicious food. And if you're, all you have to add then is either whatever carbohydrate you want, either a little bit of pasta, a bit of tagliatelle, or your potato, your wedges, whatever. Okay. You can add all then. You can do it all in the oven a lot of the time.
And they say, when I say they, I mean, I'm sure we've all heard it, breakfast is a very important meal in our general day. So two questions here, I suppose. Would you yourself live by the maxim of set meals, being disciplined enough to do breakfast, lunch and dinner, as it were, as opposed to snacking and so on? And maybe talk us through what your breakfast plan is of a week.
Mostly, I love eggs, I have to say. Now, I would be a big fan of eggs. So I would have just a scrambled egg with spinach, a bit of avocado, if I have it. I normally make my own porridge bread. So I have, and that's always full of seeds and all of that. Now, I batch break that at a weekend, and I stick it in the freezer so I have bread for the week, so I don't have to think about it. So I'd have that possibly with whatever is there in the morning. But generally speaking, that's with a bit of avocado works quite well, and you're full then. I'm a fan of intermittent fasting, so I wouldn't have breakfast every morning. So I'd have it maybe three mornings a week. I love my cup of coffee in the morning. that's a given. There's no
non-negotiable
with that. That happens. So, as I said, very fond of eggs. I have the porridge bread. I'm not a cereal fan. I have to say, I'd have chia pudding. I make up that the night before and just store it in the fridge, and you have it in the morning with some fruit. Sometimes I'd have, if I'm up for it, I might make a juice.
Okay. And
that would be about it.
One or two questions occur to me there, particularly it's just say around the eggs. There's healthier ways to do eggs and there's less healthy way to do eggs. Scrambled would be your preference to taste and to health, or what?
Well, an omelette is perfectly fine. It depends on how much, you know, kind of what you're actually cooking it in a lot of the time. If you're cooking it in, you know, I make my scrambled egg on a pan. But I use about, quarter, maybe a half teaspoon of butter on the pan, and that's how I scrambled egg. They're done in seconds. You'd have it done in less than a minute. I throw a big fistful of spinach in on top of it, a bit of black pepper, and that's it. There's no more to it than that. We've made food very complicated, I think.
Yeah.
And it's not.
No.
It's not.
And as evidenced by your generosity in being so forthcoming about your diet lifestyle, as it were, Breida. It is all very doable and it sounds pretty tasty as well. So look, I really appreciate you talking us through that this evening. Something a bit different, but really appreciate you talking to us once again on Health and Fitness.
Thanks, Amy, David. Really appreciate it.
If you love Gaelic games and love teaching, how do you leave a lasting legacy? You'll find out from Laois GAA's Head of Coaching and Games next.
Health and Fitness with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club, with fitness classes to suit everyone. Experience the warmth at 30 degrees in our dedicated spin studio. Discover all this and more on MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. Now, Gaelic Games goes beyond the intercounty senior sides that we'll see on the pitch this weekend, following weekends, all throughout the summer. Ahead of coaching and games at Laois GAA, Shane Keegan joins us on Health and Fitness once again to catch us up with the work he's been doing and Laois GAA have been doing in the community and beyond. Shane, thanks for joining us. How's the form?
No problem. Thanks for having me on, David.
Not at all. So as I said there, you guys have been plenty busy and there's a lot of important work that does get done. Ultimately, it'd be behind the scenes for the typical GAA fan, but if you're a parent, an underage coach, you know full well there's a lot gone in. You might talk us through what's been happening from your perspective as head of coaching and games at Laois GAA recently.
Yeah, 100%. Thanks, David. I suppose the first thing to highlight is it's great. We finally have what we'd call near enough a full team in place, David. We now have, including myself in the coaching and games department, we now have 12 full-time employees, which is a brilliant situation to be in. It does allow you to genuinely feel that you've got the manpower to go and try and make an actual difference, you know. And on top of that, we've also been very lucky, David, is we've had three interns in on placement from third year in sports-related colleges down in UL. Mm. I have to say, they've been absolutely excellent as well. They've been a huge, huge help to us, so they have. So we feel like we're making headway. I suppose to outline a couple of the things that we've had over the last while, we had a fantastic workshop here in the Centre of Excellence last month. We're trying to target the workshops at specific age groups, David. So we had one aimed at our kind of under 13 to under 17 club coaches. We had a brilliant turnout on the day. We had over 50 coaches in for it. The Lavin brothers, those a lot of people would be acquainted with them, they're often linked with Paul Knark, who'd be probably the foremost hurling coach in the country at the moment. The Lavin brothers were in. They did a segment of the course for us, and Niall Corcoran, who obviously was coach of our senior hurlers when they won Joe McDonough with Eddie Brendan a few years ago. Mm. So that went really, really well. Great turnout, and the positive feedback from it was absolutely excellent. So I might actually outline one or two of the other workshops we've got coming up in a couple of minutes. But yeah, in terms of the last month, one of the other, I suppose, big wins for us are an area that we're very positive about is we have 57 primary schools in Laois, David, who enter either Cumann na mBun School hurling or Cumann na mBun School football.
Yeah.
And we've got a fantastic relationship here with the Cumann na mBun School organisation. We're very lucky in Laois to have a really strong committee and organisation at Cumann na mBun School level. So as of this week, and I'm very nearly over the line with the remaining ones, as of this week, we now have consistent weekly coaching in 52 of the 57 Cumann na mBun School schools. And we're literally kind of just finalising for the remaining five that they will get up and running as soon as they come back from the Easter break. So I think to be able to offer a weekly coaching presence in every single one of our primary schools would be hoping to be huge positives to that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, Shane. Like, what objectives are you guys working towards when you're trying to deliver those kinds of numbers? What do you think could be the long-term benefits?
I think it's twofold. I think the first and most important thing is, particularly with the younger age groups, you know, we are potentially giving them their first ever GAA experience. You know, yeah. If we're in there with a junior infants or a senior infants, and, you know, sometimes we take it for granted that everybody is involved in their local GAA club, but they're not. You know, the demographics of the people that make up this country, as you're well aware, is changing dramatically, so it is. So therefore, we need to make more of an effort and make sure that all the kids are getting a GAA experience, one, and then more importantly, do everything we can to make sure that GAA experience is an extremely positive and fun one for them. The idea being, you're hoping that a kid goes home from school and says, listen, you know, I had a hurl in my hand for the first time today, or I tried out Gaelic football for the first time today, and I really, really had great fun at it in school. And mom or dad, is there any chance you'd take me down to the local GA club where I can do a bit more of it? And that's very much the first aim and the core aim. And then, look, aside from that, there is an element of talent development in it as well. You know, the more exposure we can give to both of our games, the more people are playing it. Obviously, we'd be hoping the more their skills improve. So, you know, for those that are already in GAA clubs, the extra training, the extra coaching will hopefully mean that as players, they will improve their own skill set.
It's an interesting point you make about kind of the participation numbers being a big part of it. And as you say, because of changing demographics, it's not like maybe the memories you or I would have had about how you were as much given a school uniform as you were a hurl or something along those lines. Hurling in the country nationally has gotten has been the subject of quite a bit of debate over the last few months in terms of getting counties that don't have great participation numbers up. There's people railing against the idea of individual figures coming to counties and trying to fix it all by themselves. Do you think it's a case that the GAA needs to enact a step change in investment? Is there anything, do you think, that other counties could learn from what Laois are doing? Obviously, Laois has a proud history in hurling, but it is a kind of in between the elites and those who really struggle to develop the game.
Yeah, 100%. And look, in reality, what are we trying to do? We're trying to close that gap. That's what we're trying to do in Laois on the hurling side of things. Look, as you say, there are emerging counties coming from behind us who are kind of putting pressure on our own position in the pecking order, while at the same time we're trying to put pressure on those above us. And look, it is my belief that, you know, just purely focusing on your seniors or your 20s in terms of where you're at in the pecking order will only, you know, give very short-term indication. Really, it's at the very, very bottom, and it's got to be, it absolutely has to be a 20-plus year plan in terms of how we're going to try and get to the levels that the Limericks and the Kilkennys and those are at. You're quite simply not going to catch up with those kind of guys overnight, David. So it has to start at the bottom, and starting at the bottom means putting a hurl in the hand of 5-year-old and junior infants.
There's no better cause to be a part of, I think, Shane. So fair play on that front. Let's look towards the near future then. What have you got coming up that's kind of piquing your excitement?
Yeah, our formal education, that workshop I outlined to you a few minutes ago, that's, I suppose, our informal pathway. Our formal education pathway, which is at base level, the introduction to Gaelic games, and then our Award 1s is the next step up. We've just finished an Award 1 football. We've just finished an Award 1 hurling. We're currently, I think we've only one night left in our Award 1 football. But the level below that, the introduction to Gaelic games, David, it's actually within the GAA rules that every person who steps onto a training ground to help out as a support coach within their clubs is supposed to have completed their introduction to Gaelic games hurling or their introduction to Gaelic games football. So we've had a huge amount of success. The clubs have bought into that massively over January and February, and we've ran a massive amount of those courses. But I still think we probably need one of each as a kind of a catch-all to get those who haven't had a chance to do it yet. So we're going to run those over the next 2 weekends. We're going to do our introduction to Gaelic games here in the Centre of Excellence on Sunday, the 24th of March. And we're going to do an introduction to Gaelic games hurling the following weekend on Saturday, the 30th of March. So there are two important ones for us. In addition to that, another area that I'm sure you'll agree, particularly with the show that you're doing there, I think there's a massively increasing interest in the whole area of physical fitness and physical conditioning and fundamental movements. So we're going to run 3 workshops. Again, we're going to break them up by age groups, David. We're going to do our first one is going to be on the 23rd of March. That's going to be aimed at coaches who are working at club level with under 15 or minor teams. The following week on Saturday, the 30th, we're going to do the same, but this time for coaches who are working with under 11 and under 13. And then the one we still have to pencil in, we're just looking to nail down a date for it, will be our final one, will be a kind of a real fundamental movements one aimed at coaches of under 7 and under 9. So I think, again, as I said, there's a lot of interest. I think club coaches want to know more and how they can help their players in that respect. So I think they're certainly worthwhile doing too, you would think.
Yeah, sounds like there's a lot of deliberate investment being put into the infrastructure of Gaelic Games education in the county. That must be something that gives you great encouragement to know that the work you're doing day to day, it's kind of going to leave its own legacy in a way.
Yeah. Look, you would certainly hope so. And I think, as I say, we're doing a lot right. I would say certainly we're not doing everything right, but I think we're hopefully making strides. And it is moving in the right direction. I should, by the way, also highlight it that late notice, but we actually have a workshop tomorrow as well. A really, really good one with a guy called Shane Smith. A lot of people will be aware of him. Shane is a brilliant coach at kind of Go Games level. Now we've had to move it, David, so as much to highlight the new location. We were planning on doing it here in the Centre of Excellence, but as you're well aware, weather is playing havoc with everybody's plans at the moment. So we've actually shifted that tomorrow morning over to the indoor arena in Ballinakil, which is a fantastic facility. So that's taking place over there from 9:15 to 10:45 tomorrow, which will be a really, really good workshop. And there are still a couple of tickets left for that if anybody wanted to jump on that at the last minute as well. So, no, look, as you say, you know, there takes a fair bit of organisation, planning, you know, a bit of cost and all that kind of stuff in all of these things. I have no doubt that it will bear fruit.
And that's our lot for this week's show. Thanks as ever for taking the time to join me. I'll be back with you on news from Tuesday, and Health and Fitness returns on Friday.